TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Dangers of Climate Change. The Bush Wars Against Climate Science. This is the last program in a three-hour series on the dangers of climate change. In February of 2005, a conference was held at the Hadley Center in Exeter, England, on how to avoid dangerous climate change. Over 200 of the world's top scientists from 30 countries were attending. They presented the most up-to-date findings in the fields of oceanography, glaciology, biology, meteorology, and ecology. They were seeing a dramatic rise in the last 50 years of all the indicators of climate change: increase in average world temperatures, in the levels of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and in the level of the oceans. From ice core studies, we know that carbon dioxide concentrations on this planet had been stable for the last millennium. They were never more than 10 parts per million off and fluctuated between 275 and 285 parts per million. Now CO2 concentrations are beginning to exceed 370 parts per million and are rising from year to year. Other greenhouse gases show the same dramatic increase, mainly in the past 40 to 50 years. We are already living under a dome of air that no one has breathed in a million years. But worse, the opening presentations at the Exeter Conference introduced four new so-called wild cards: the accelerated melting of the enormous ice sheets of the Antarctic and Greenland, and the recent discovery that not just our atmosphere, but also our oceans have become overloaded with CO2. A decline and possible reversal of the Gulf Stream that carries heat from the tropics to Europe was also mentioned. The conference was held to provide data to the governments of the G8 countries: England, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, Japan, Russia, and the US. At the G8 meeting in Gleneagles, Scotland, they were to come up with a consensus on climate change. Hopes were high that the US would finally agree to placing limits on CO2 emissions. All other G8 members had already done that when they signed on to the Kyoto Protocol. Well, the July 2005 G8 meeting came and went, and George Bush and the U.S. delegation, representing the world's largest polluter with 42% of global CO2 emissions from fossil fuels, refused to set limits and even managed to reduce other climate goals set by the conference planners. That Tony Blair could declare with a straight face to the media that progress had been made at the G8 meeting can only be understood if one considers the deception and outright lies on climate change propagated for years and up to this day by corporations such as ExxonMobil, by the Bush administration and the White House Council on Environmental Quality, by the Petroleum Institute, and most of the U.S. media. Among the over 40 think tanks funded by oil money, the Competitive Enterprise Institute stands out prominently. Its director, Myron Ebell, is George Bush's advisor on climate change. The British media, unlike most of their American counterparts, have challenged the so-called climate skeptics for years. I searched the archives of the BBC and found a clip from the 2003 documentary Diary of Climate Change. Here's the BBC reporter questioning Myron Ebell.
I've been talking to an American who advises President Bush on climate change, Myron Ebell, who is the director of global warming at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington. I asked him about the whole question of climate change.
The whole tissue of argument that makes climate change into the greatest problem facing humanity is based on a long series of improbabilities.
How do you deal with the fact that there is no previous time in recorded history when the world's temperature has risen so much and so quickly?
Oh, I don't think that's true at all.
Notwithstanding that the overwhelming majority of the world's climatologists believe that this is precisely what is going on, that we are seeing a rapid and frightening increase in the world's temperature.
There are a bunch of climate modelers who take unrealistic assumptions and get out unrealistic forecasts.
And how do you deal with facts, and that this is not a matter of speculation or modelling, how do you deal with facts such as the rise in carbon dioxide levels that has taken place? There is no doubt about that, and that is consistent with the increase in global warming.
There are two possibilities here. One is, the models are tuned much too high, that they assume that the climate is much more sensitive to CO2 than it actually is, or there's some mystery factor, which we have no idea what it is, that is somehow concealing the warming that has already occurred. Now, I think one of these is a scientific explanation. I think the other one is just fantasy.
Is it not possible that there is another theory, which is that people in the United States who deny global warming do so because they are the biggest polluters in the world and they are simply not prepared to change their lifestyles?
Yes, that is a possibility. I would put another possibility to you, which is we still have independent scientists in this country.
And no other country does?
Not to any real degree, no, because virtually all scientific funding in Europe and Japan and Australia is held directly from government.
Myron Ebel, many thanks.
That was a clip from the BBC documentary Diary of Climate Change. As you can imagine, it created a huge response by listeners, ranging from disbelief to outrage. While Myron Ebel was claiming on the BBC that only the US had independent scientists, his think tank, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, was using a new Orwellian law, the Federal Data Quality Act, to challenge two important scientific documents, the National Assessment on Climate Change and the EPA Climate Action Report. Discrediting of the science of climate change is an ongoing systematic effort. In May of this year, Mother Jones carried an exposé of ExxonMobil and listed 40 policy groups and individuals who are funded by ExxonMobil to undermine the scientific consensus that humans are causing the Earth to overheat and that fossil fuel burning is changing the composition of our air. One irony is that while the oil industry denies the science of climate change, it has to deal with the reality of global warming in its operations. Hurricanes that lash the drilling platforms in the Gulf of Mexico are becoming more frequent and severe as they pick up energy from the warming oceans. The season for oil drilling in Alaska has already been shortened by half as winters are becoming shorter and the heavy equipment sinks into the thawing tundra. Undaunted by those experiences, the oil industry and their representatives in the administration and Congress continue to spend millions of dollars to keep science on climate change from public view. One of the most intriguing such incidents is the story of the hockey stick graph. Even naming it a hockey stick was already an attempt to ridicule one of the most provocative symbols of global warming, a chart that could not fail to frighten anybody who had a chance to see it. The so-called hockey stick is a chart of temperature variations over the past 1,000 years that shows a very sharp rise in temperatures, especially within the last 50 years. The graph is relatively flat from the period AD 1000 to 1900, indicating that temperatures were quite stable for this period of time. The flat part forms the shaft of the so-called hockey stick. But after 1900, temperatures turn up and continue to rise, forming the hockey stick's blade. This chart, developed by three scientists, among them Michael Mann of the University of Virginia, was published in prestigious magazines such as Nature. The graph was included in 2001 in the third assessment report of the IPCC, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The inclusion of the graph in the IPCC report gave it the status of a policy recommendation, a stark warning that human activities are causing climate change and that action needs to be taken soon. The Petroleum Institute went on the counterattack and contributed to the funding of a paper that was to debunk the hockey stick graph. For science, the so-called Soon-Balyunas paper remained without consequences. But for politicians, it became an important document. It was used and even distributed in print by George Bush and Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma. As the newly appointed chair of the Environment Committee of the U.S. Senate, Senator Inhofe expressed his view on science and the hockey stick.
I started, when I became chairman of this committee, to look at the science. And I couldn't find a lot of science that would justify other than the Michael Mann science and the hockey stick. And that's why I used that to show what type of science was there. And the science is not there. And I said in a speech on the floor, which has been quoted, I think perhaps this may go down as the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people.
That was Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma, chair of the Environment Committee of the U.S. Senate. Thanks to the BBC Web Archive for the clip. Senator Inhofe keeps repeating his statements on junk science and climate change as hoax to this day. And all the while, most of the media played along, obediently quoting him and undermining a public debate that is so urgently needed on this issue. Meanwhile, as the hockey stick temperature data graph acquired the status of a favored target of the oil lobby and Bush administration, literally dozens of other hockey sticks in the literature and science of climate change were overlooked. Opening the pages of the report, Global Change and the Earth Systems, A Planet Under Pressure, issued by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, one can be shocked to see the familiar graph repeated page after page. Right next to the original hockey stick graph on temperature are the graphs for CO2 and two other important greenhouse gases, methane and nitrogen. They also look exactly like a hockey stick. What is of concern to us alive today is that the sudden uptick, the blade of the hockey stick, falls into our lifetimes and that of our parents. All the events on this list occur and are careening off the charts in a steep upward turn from 1950 to now. 1950 is the year where ozone depletion accelerates. Water use shoots up, along with nitrogen fertilizer use. Other factors, like the curve for species extinction, logging of rainforests, building in coastal zones, and expansion of fisheries, all begin a radical rise around 1950. Beginning with the Industrial Revolution, but greatly sped up in the last 50 years, humanity has produced a planet with a temperature and weather patterns and chemistry of air, water, and soil that has never existed before. Now, there may be some cynical enough to think that is an interesting science fiction experiment, or greedy enough to want to extract the last drop of oil from the dying earth for a profit, or maybe fundamentalist religious enough to assume that God has given them dominion over the planet to do as they wish. But what about the rest of us, not cynical, not greedy, and not arrogant? It is pretty clear that there need to be big changes in the way we live. And I guess it is also clear already that that is frightening, since we have become so dependent on this technological civilization. However, scientists tell us that the extreme weather events, such as floods, hurricanes, sea level rise, and unprecedented heat waves, are more frightening than any change in the way we choose to live now. And they told us at the Exeter Conference, which was covered in part by this radio series, that if we do nothing to stop it, the climate will collapse. Some say it will be soon, The estimate of the International Climate Change Task Force, UK, says the point of no return could be reached in a decade. The Bush delegation to the just-concluded G8 summit in Scotland, probably even George Bush himself, are aware of that number. It comes from Stephen Byers, the co-chair of that task force, and an advisor to Tony Blair. It had no effect. It appears that governments are unable to make the required change. Tony Blair, in spite of his rhetoric about the looming threat of climate change, did not have the strength to stand up to George Bush. Neither did the other heads of government. Scientists who met in Exeter, England in early 2005 to define dangerous climate change said that the Earth should not warm more than 2 degrees Celsius world average, and we are halfway there, and that the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere should not exceed 500 parts per million, and we are 3/4 way there. Based on the current use of oil, it means that the world needs to reduce emissions by 50% by 2050, and rich countries need to cut their emissions by 30% by 2020. Since the G8 heads of state just chose to ignore these simple and important numbers, it is up to us to make sure the advice gets applied. To inspire us along that route, as well as to encourage all those who are still unsure if all this is a serious matter, I want to extend an invitation to follow up on the scientific research. There are magazines, websites, books, and occasional news items that keep up with new findings and ongoing reporting. There are links to the Exeter meeting and some of the organizations on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs page. I'm sure this will be an amazing journey for you. There may have never been a time where scientists had access to such specific, detailed global information. Underwater robots follow the Gulf Stream and send up records on temperature and salinity. Satellites and airplanes fly over the polar caps and return with data not only about the surface of the snowpacks, but the shape of land buried by ice. Drilling rigs on Greenland and in the Antarctic extract ice cores going down several miles. They allow us to read climate history up to 900,000 years ago. When I interviewed Chris Rapley, the director of the British Antarctic Survey, I asked him about these new research methods. He had used slides in his talk at Exeter that showed in detail all features of the land mass that is buried under the Antarctic ice for the last 20 million years. I thought of the stories of explorers who just 100 years ago risked their lives to only see a small part of the surface of a continent for which now a detailed map exists. How do we know what that buried continent looks like, I asked. And how can we measure the speed of flow of glacier meltwater streams buried under mile-high ice? Chris Rapley.
The map that shows what the Antarctic would look like if you lifted off or melted all of the ice comes mainly from airborne radar data, because you need low-frequency radars to penetrate through the ice, and powerful ones too. That's mainly been compiled from radar data and gravity data using gravity sensors on aircraft. And really, that's the result of a huge collaboration. I've forgotten offhand how many nations were involved. I think it was 27 nations pooled all of the data that they've gathered over the last 40 years and constructed that map. It was called the BedMap project, for obvious reasons. The actual ice flow, these dendritic flows, I mean, it's been known for a while that just like you have on the Alps or any large mountain range, an accumulation area, a basin that collects snow, and that this will flow under its own weight downhill, and it'll be guided by the channels in the rock and will form a sort of ice stream or glacier. it was known that all the way around the edge of the Antarctic you had these glaciers. They're very easy to see because the ice is at its brittle point and it cracks and you get crevasses and you can see the flow lines. It's just obvious looking at them. But the way that people used to measure how quickly they were flowing was literally to stick a stick in the in a point and come back a bit later on, and having surveyed where the stick was on one occasion, see how far it had moved when they came back. So it's very, very crude and also very time-consuming, and you didn't get many data points. What's absolutely wonderful is that satellite radar imagery, which is something that first came into being with the US CSAT satellite, NASA CSAT satellite in 76, I think it was, designed to do oceanography, can also take, these radars can take images of land masses and ice masses and so on, and you can get the topography out, you can get the surface shape out. But what the Jet Propulsion Lab saw was that you could, because you had the information about the phase of the radar returns, you could compare one image with another, and you could get interference patterns out of them. And this is something that Newton would have understood. He did a lot of work with interference patterns in light. Well, you can get interference patterns out of these, out of comparing these images, which allow you to get very accurate topography. But if you then look at them in threes, you can also extract the motion of the pieces in the ice that are causing the major reflections back from the surface to the satellite radar. And you can actually figure out, by sort of double-differencing these images, how these inclusions or reflectors in the surface have moved. So you can actually measure from one series of radar images to another how far different pieces of the ice have moved. So you can just map the flow of these ice streams. And the amazing thing was that you've got these quite large motions of anything up to a kilometer or so per year near the coast. And we always knew that there was a sort of pattern working its way back up into the ice sheet, this sort of dendritic pattern, just like any sort of drainage basin, water drainage basin, where you got motions of tens of meters per year. But this fantastically sensitive space technique shows that these fingers of motion penetrate far deeper into the ice sheet than anybody realized, because the motions are so small. It would be very difficult to measure them on the surface. So the space imagery, the satellite radar imagery, has just transformed what we know about the flow of the ice sheet. What it means is that if you have a change near the coast, presumably if it causes an acceleration of the flow, the effect of this can be felt far deeper into the bulk of the ice sheet than we ever previously realized. So this is another thing that we've learned since the IPCC, and it's another reason to reevaluate just how stable these ice sheets are. So anyway, you asked me how do you see these things from space, and those are the two answers.
Could we just close with some thoughts about this amazing fact that we have so much more detail about all this? We have come to this time and space where we actually really know what we're doing, and it doesn't have an impact on our actions yet, everywhere.
Yeah, it's odd. I regard myself as an Earth system scientist, and before I was here at this Antarctic Institute, I ran one of the two big global change research programs. And if you look at the expenditure and indeed the sort of outcome, the U.S. spends, I guess, anywhere between $1 billion and $2 billion a year on global change or climate change research, Earth system research of one sort or another. The United States does half, Europe does a quarter, the rest of the world does the other quarter. So from the point of view of having access to knowledge and information and understanding, the U.S. should be at the forefront. You know, you've got, what is it? I can't remember the relative population, 12% of the population or something rather, and all that knowledge. And so it's a puzzle to me, really, as to why there is so much skepticism and ignorance in the United States, general public, and in the administration about these issues. It's just odd. It's possibly something to do with the way the media deal with the subject. Maybe they feel that people aren't interested in science and that this is science and not kind of important information for people to use to guide their lives and actions. I don't know what it is. This is a really tricky issue, because to cope with this, it requires each of us substantially to change the way we live.
That was Chris Wapley, director of the British Antarctic Survey, on the recent discovery of a network of subglacial streams that explain the accelerated melting of the western parts of the Antarctic. This really is a small planet. These sounds of breaking glaciers and the songs of leopard seals were recorded in Antarctica. The breaking ice so far away is connected to us by cause and effect. This is an invitation to extend attention and love. This is the last part of a 3-hour radio series on the dangers of climate change. You can find out more about the series on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. The series presents recent research on the warming of the Antarctic and Greenland, the acidification of oceans, on risks to the ocean currents, and to plants and animals. Thanks to the staff of the Hadley Center in Exeter, England, for making the recordings of that extraordinary conference available. And thanks to Douglas Quinn for the recording of the Antarctic ice sounds. You can get information how to order a copy of the program you just heard, which included Impacts on Oceans and Land, by calling us. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your tape or CD order is the only support we receive and helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gallardon. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.